Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to another Torah in Motion panel discussion. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut, and today we're looking at Israel as a religious state, challenges and opportunities. Now, while Israel is often referred to as the Jewish state by Prime Minister Netanyahu, among others, the term raises the specter of exactly what is the Jewish identity of the state, and also reverse whether the state should be involved in Jewish identity. And this issue, of course, predates 1948. Theodor Herzl dreamed of a secular state in which religion would have no influence whatsoever. He writes in his visionary 1896 work, The Jewish State, quote, "We shall keep our priests within the confines of their temples," unquote. But David Ben-Gurion, in a sense, ignored this advice and included religious leaders alongside secular Jews in his government. And moreover, he granted rabbis a powerful role in society, a monopoly on performing marriages and divorces. And it was Yeshaya Leibowitz in his essay, The Religious Significance of the State of Israel, who remarks pointedly that no state whatsoever in any era, any culture, including Jewish culture, ever was or will be anything but a secular institution. The function of the state is essentially secular. It is not service of God, and the state as such has no religious value, unquote. So a kind of paradox arises. On the one hand, polls seem to consistently find that many Israelis want to be left alone and free to practice their way of life without any interference from religious authorities in any way. This would entail things like not having to get married under the auspices of the rabbinate, or diversion of public funds away from a narrow Torah education with no general studies components, or the drafting of Haredim into the IDF, or the elimination of the reduction of the power of the chief rabbinate, and perhaps more things open on Shabbat, and so on. But on the other hand, the government of Israel has proposed a new Jewish identity administration, a 5 million shekel initiative meant to, quote, raise awareness of and identification with the basic components of our national Jewish heritage among Israelis. The initiative was one of Habayit HaYehudi Chairman Naftali Bennett's demands for joining the government coalition. So there still seems to be government interest, some would say interference, in how Israelis negotiate their Jewish lives. So the issues surrounding Israel as a Jewish state and the question of what roles government should play to promote or even enforce that Jewish character are very complex, and our panelists today are well suited to tackle these issues, and it's my pleasure to introduce them to you in alphabetical order, and please hold your applause till we're done. To my immediate right, Professor Moshe Kapel teaches in the Department of Computer Science at Bar-Ilan University. He studied at Yeshiva University and Yeshivat Har Etzion. He received his PhD in math from NYU's Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences and did postdoctoral work in the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He's published many articles on rabbinic literature. He's co-founded and co-edited the journal Higayon, which is devoted to math and halakha. He has co-drafted two proposed constitutions for Israel, and several laws that he drafted have been passed by the Knesset. He's a founder and chairman of the Kohelet Policy Forum. On the left here, Shmuel Rosner is an Israeli columnist and editor, the political editor of the Jewish Journal. He writes a weekly column for the International New York Times. For several years, he wrote for Haaretz, and his blog entitled Rosner's Domain is featured in the Jerusalem Post. Mr. Rosner has also written for the New Republic, the Jewish Review of Books, and other publications. In 2009, he was appointed nonfiction editor for Kinneret Zmora Bitan Dvir, an Israeli publishing house. He also joined the Jewish People Policy Institute as a fellow and started writing a weekend column for Maariv. To my immediate left, Rabbi Reuven Tradberg is a stranger to no one in Toronto. He's now the director of the Israel Office of the Rabbinical Council of America. He received his BA from Carleton and Smicha from Yeshiva University, at first an assistant rabbi of the Young Israel of Staten Island and the rabbi in Birmingham, Alabama, before serving as rabbi of Kehilat Shari Torah of Toronto from 1994 until his aliyah in 2009. In addition to those duties, he was the secretary of the Beit Din of the Vada Rabbanim of Toronto from 1997 to 2007, and president of the VOD from 2007-2009. And as I said, him and his wife Joyce made aliyah in 2009, and they reside in Jerusalem. And to the right here, David Weinberg, who writes on Israeli diplomacy and defense, Israeli politics and society, and Israel diaspora relations. He holds a master's degree in international relations from Bar-Ilan. His work has appeared in the Jerusalem Post, Israel Ayom, among other publications. He met Aliyah in 1990 from Toronto, And as a senior advisor to Natasha Sharansky, he was founding coordinator of the Global Forum Against Anti-Semitism. He has also served as the spokesman for the Herzliya Conference on National Security and for Bar-Ilan, as the public affairs director for the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan. Please welcome our panelists. All right, Professor Gappell, we'll start with you. You have argued forcefully for, quote, drastically limiting the role of the Israeli state in developing and maintaining Jewish institutions. You say that you do so, however, as one who very much wishes to see an expansion of the influence of traditional Judaism in the Israeli public square. But in your view, this expansion is possible only if the state stops usurping power better held by Jewish communities which have successfully transmitted and evolved Jewish moral traditions for millennia. So I want to ask a series of questions. I want everyone to weigh in. We'll start with Professor Gappell. Why do you think it is harmful to have the state involved in religion? And just to flesh out the question, opponents of your view would argue that removing the state from religion simply places Israel on a par with every other Western non-Jewish country where religion is relegated to the private sphere. What makes Israel different? And the flip side, do you think there are any areas where you feel government can play a role Jewishly? Say the issue that's come up in the last number of years, Women of the Wall, doesn't that force the government to become involved in what might be seen as a strictly Jewish matter or issues of conversion and so on?
Okay. And answer all of them in under 2 minutes.
Right. Okay, so there were some big questions there. Let me try, if I can, to at least cover the main topics. The reason I don't want the state involved too much in religion is that I don't want the state involved too much in almost anything. The question that we have to ask with regard to any of the issues that states frequently are tempted to get involved in is the state going to do a good job at that? Is the state better at running schools than communities are at running schools, or worse? Now, with regard to religion, it's particularly complicated and thorny. There are many different ways in which the state can interact with religion. The first thing, though, I should point out, you asked how Israel is going to be different than other countries. It depends which country, obviously, but let's take the United States as an example because it's a very good example of separation of religion and state. I don't advocate separation of religion and state in Israel. I think that would be an absurd idea. Israel was founded for the purpose of being the nation state of the Jewish people, and I think it should serve exactly that purpose. If you have separation of religion and state, as you do in the United States, that would mean that you couldn't have any established religion, that the state couldn't be involved in funding schools if they had any religious affiliation, that you couldn't have school prayer. There are all kinds of ways in which I think it would be ludicrous to talk about separation of religion and state in Israel. Nevertheless, to the extent that one can limit the influence of the state on religion in Israel, I'm in favor of doing so. Briefly, there are three areas in which the state could be involved in religion. The first one is the most benign, and that's a state has to have an official language. A state has to have an official immigration policy. A state has to have official symbols. A state has to have an official calendar. On all of these things, there's no neutral position, and I want the state of Israel to serve as the nation state of the Jewish people, and precisely in the sense that the national language will be Hebrew, that its immigration policies will favor the immigration of Jews, that its calendar will be the Jewish calendar, and so on. In fact, I've authored a law that's now being discussed in the Knesset exactly on that purpose. Chok Yisod Medinat Israel Kebayit Halum Mishalom Yehudi, and it covers all of that. The second area that the state can be, where a state can interact with religion is religious legislation. A state can have laws that you can't sell chametz on Pesach, that you can't sell treif, that you have to do a bris milah. There is no such law, but one can imagine such a law, etc., etc. With regard to this, my feeling is somewhat divided. I'm opposed to principled arguments against religious basis for legislation. There's no reasonable principled argument against it any more than there's a principled argument against feminism or environmentalism or socialism or pick your favorite ism being a foundation for legislative proposals. Religion and Judaism in particular should certainly be no less than any other ism. However, having said that, if we move from the principled sphere to the practical one, I think most cases of religious legislation, one has to look at the costs of doing so, the resentment that it arouses, and more, the fact that it brings the courts into the sphere of religion and allows them to make religious decisions that I don't think they should be making. That's the cost. The benefits may be that we have a public square that's more to our liking, if that's our liking. So I think there that we simply need to look at each proposed piece of religious legislation and decide what are the costs, what are the benefits, and whether the trade-off is worthwhile. The third area where the state can be involved in religion is through established religion, namely by having a state-appointed rabbinate that takes its authority from the state and so forth. I think with regard to this, and I'm sure we'll get into this in greater detail as we go on, I don't want to talk for too long right now, but briefly I think that that the established rabbinate in Israel, for the most part, does more harm than good.
Anybody want to weigh in here? Yeah, go.
Would you think that the state should pay for community rabbis?
It depends.
To build shuls and mikvahs?
Okay, so if I tell you that I think that's a bad idea, your response is going to be, well, they build operas and they build all kinds of goofy stuff for other people.
It's right there.
Yeah, okay. So, right, so we can do the dance if you want. You say your stuff, I'll say my stuff, and, you know, we'll get where we're going. But the upshot is I don't care. My objective here isn't to get what I deserve because, you know, the opera lovers are getting their opera. If it were up to me, the state wouldn't fund the opera or shuls. Okay, so at least I'm consistent. But even given the fact that the state is funding operas, I don't see that there's great benefit in the state funding shuls. Principally because, if I'll take up your question about rabbis, okay, let's assume that the two are intimately connected, and if the state funds shuls, it's going to fund rabbis. I don't so much mind the state funding rabbis as I do the state appointing rabbis, because if they fund them, then they also buy the right, possibly even the duty, to decide who is going to serve in those positions. And I think the communities have to pick their own rabbis and not have rabbis that are appointed by state officials. When state officials appoint rabbis, several things happen. One of them is communities don't get the rabbis they deserve. They get rabbis that people on that committee think should be on that committee, either because they're benign or because they're their brother-in-law. If rabbis are guaranteed their salary by the state and don't have to earn the respect of their communities, they're likely, as David Hume already pointed out hundreds of years ago, to become indolent, to not do their job because they have no incentive to do their job. Even if they were to be the kind of people who do their job because they're that kind of people and they don't need financial incentives and so forth to do it, they are civil servants. As civil servants, they are limited in what they're able to do and what they're able to say. Take, for example, the chief rabbi of Tzfat, who said that in his opinion it was halakhically impermissible to rent apartments to Arabs. You can agree with that opinion or you can disagree with it, but the result was that he came under fire and he was ruled by the attorney general to be ineligible to run for the position of chief rabbi because the attorney general disagrees with that opinion. And as a civil servant, he is subject to those constraints. So for all of these reasons, I think that it would be it is a really bad idea to have rabbis funded by the state. Yes.
Moish, the only reason we're having this conversation is because the system has gone bad. because the rabbinate has become rife with nepotism, cronyism, fundamentalism, obstinacy, laziness, and general malfeasance. The danger is that because the system is broke, we run the risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And instead of saying, let's fix the system, you're saying, let's drop the system altogether. I still believe that the vision of a national rabbinate that is both loyal to tradition and responsive to the needs of the public and at ease with the social mores of the public is a vision worth working for, and it's worth trying to fix the system. Now, we all know we just went through a difficult, bitter race for the selection of new chief rabbis. They're elected once every 10 years. It's a long term. And the so-called modern candidate, the more moderate candidate, Rav David Stav of the Tzohar Rabbinical Organization, lost and lost badly. And two Haredi chief rabbis were elected, both of whom are sons of former Haredi chief rabbis, and that doesn't augur well for change or the type of change that I have in mind. But it doesn't mean we throw the whole system out and strip the country of the resources of a rabbi.
Okay. You all just got lucky because I wrote a long article for tomorrow about this topic, and I'm going to save you the trouble of having to read it. What you just saw here with the last two speakers, with Moshe and David, is exactly the two opposite positions that most Israelis hold in regards to how do we want to treat the rabbinate and religious legislation in Israel. One way, Moshe's way, is the revolutionary way. Let's take it all, dismantle it, eliminate it, get rid of it. It's trouble, it damages Israel more than it helps Israel. The other way is David's way. It's not about revolutionizing the system, it's about circumventing it. The way I describe it in the article, I call it the Mapainik way. Mapainik in Israel, when we say about something, it's Mapainik. Mapai is the name of the Mapai party that is known for flexible ideology. So being Mapainik about the Rabbanut means that instead of dismantling it, we'll find way around it. Two examples from the last week. Just in the last week, Israel began the process of passing two important laws, one concerning marriage, the other one concerning conversion, the ministerial committee on legislation. Just today passed the first stage, passed the proposed legislation on conversion. Now, these two laws are basically identical. What do they say? We have a very problematic rabbinate. The rabbis who sit in Jerusalem and in many other places in Israel are resistant to change, are unfriendly, they don't give good service to Israelis. So what do? We open the system. We tell Israelis that they no longer have to be registered for marriage or to be converted by their local rabbi. What does it mean? If you live in a city in which the rabbi is a Haredi, staunchly opposed to a friendly service to the public, you go to the next city where a more friendly rabbi, a smiling and a more accommodating public servant will give you the service that you need from the rabbinate. So these are the two ways of treating the rabbinate. I can tell you that personally I prefer Moshe's way. However, from experience, I can testify that Israelis, in most cases, choose the Mapainik way. They will choose to find ways around the system instead of attempting to revolutionize it.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. I just want to point out that I know many Haredim who smile. I just want to... Okay. Obviously, one of the central problems of discussing religion and state, and the one that gets a lot of headlines around the world, is the issue of what's now called the question of equal burden sharing by Haredim, of which one aspect is, of course, serving in the IDF. Mr. Weinberg, you've written quite incisively of certain proposals that have been floated by politicians to criminalize non-service in the army, and that was a central issue in the last national election. You write that the new Haredi draft law needs significant revision because in the current form, the plan suspiciously delays treatment of the problem for years and unwisely sets Israel up for violent confrontation in the future. So, in other words, until 2017, the present legislation gives a blanket and permanent exemption from military service to all Haredi men. So it wouldn't kick in for another 4 years. As you write, that's 27,000 men, 21 years and over at this moment, who will never serve in the army, along with 7,000 additional Haredi boys who will turn 18 each year between now and 2017. Right, so if you do the math, you're talking in the mid-50,000s. So in 2017, then, the plan slaps an across-the-board blanket draft order on the Haredi community and hits Haredim with criminal sanctions if they don't bend. It threatens to imprison every Haredi man who doesn't sign up by age 21 except for 1,800 so-called exceptional Torah scholars. And you write, this radical approach, first letting all Haredim off the hook and then threatening to throw all of them in jail, is a recipe for civil war and the breakdown of law and order. The ultra-Orthodox community will defiantly circle the wagons and proudly declare, we're all criminals, you know, throw us in jail. And when the government fails to arrest them all, because there's no practical way to do this, the conscription law will become a dead letter and the rule of law is a joke, unquote. Now, what you write makes a lot of sense to me. So, the question really becomes, do you believe that alternative proposals that are floated around, right, which involve financial incentives and disincentives? In other words, instead of throwing a person in jail, we say to them, you know, there's going to be financial penalty if you don't serve, and there's going to be financial incentive if you do serve. Do you think that can work? Work from two sides, right? Do you feel that Haredi will ultimately accept this? In other words, does it really make a difference how you couch it? Because the answer will still be, no, we're never going to go. And secondly, on the other side, the Chilani public, will they be able to tolerate a kind of slower pace of such development?
Okay, thank you. My short answer is yes. The longer answer is this. First of all, it's critical to approach the Haredi draft issue without animus and without a triumphant approach which says we're going to crush the Haredi community, we're going to force them into Israeli society, into the working world, and into the military. I don't belong to that school. It's a mistake. It won't work, and it's wrong. However, the country has a critical national need. The Jewish people has a critical national need to draw the ultra-Orthodox community slowly and with love into taking more responsibility for the country, and that means entering the workforce and at some point and to some degree also assuming the national burden through partial national service and military service. And the reason why it's a critical national need is the following, and I think it's important to simply put some basic facts and statistics on the table that lay out the dimensions of the problem. Haredi community in Israel today, the ultra-Orthodox community, is about 11-12% of the country. That's about 750,000 to 850,000 Jews. But 40% of them are under the age of 14, which means that the growth rate of that community is enormous. Their natural growth rate is about 5% a year versus the Israeli national average of about 1.3% a year. Who, 15, 20 years from now, is going to go to university? Who is going to go to the military? Who's going to run our high-tech companies? Who's going to win Nobel Prizes? if the Haredi community gets no education and is not drawn into the mainstream reality. The average rate of employment in Israeli society for men is over 80%. In the Haredi community, it's 40%, literally half. The average monthly income in the Haredi community is under 6,000 shekels a month. That's about half of what of the monthly income in general society. The poverty rate is over 60%. At the moment, there are over 50,000 men, Haredi men, opting out of national service. That's about 15% of the annual draft cohort, meaning 15% of 18-year-olds. That will triple to almost 50%, about over close to 45% within a decade based on the statistics that I just outlined to you. And you have to remember that at age 22, 70% of Haredi men are married with children at age 22. So this is not something that can simply be swept under the carpet, and it's not something that you can change overnight. Your question, Elliot, to me was, can economics serve to draw them out of their current self-imposed isolation and closer to our reality? And my answer is definitely yes, and here's proof from this morning's newspaper. One of the most difficult issues in educating the Haredi world is that up until now, the Haredi world has refused to accept the core curriculum, what's known as the core curriculum, and have it taught in their schools. English, math, modern Hebrew, that's the core curriculum, and the expanded core curriculum includes civics, history, and science. The new education minister, Shai Piron, came into office several months ago, and he immediately slapped a ban. He cut payments to Haredi schools that don't teach the core curriculum to 35% of their budget. In other words, he took away tens of millions, I think even hundreds of millions of shekels from the Haredi community, and they're in total crisis. And it forced them into a negotiation with the government. There's now an advanced negotiation between the four Haredi school systems and the Israeli government about accepting the mini core curriculum. And the deal on the table right now is that in exchange for their being willing to teach math, English, and basic Hebrew in all Haredi classes, and submitting to national standardization tests to ensure that they're meeting those standards, Piron will bump up their funding again from 35% to 75% of their school budgets. And he's willing to throw in, and this is very controversial, an additional sweetener to allow schools in the Haredi world to open with numbers as small as 150 or 200 students. In general, as you know, large schools are more efficient and more easy to track and more easy to supervise. Haredi world is divided into so many subdivisions and subsects that each individual chassidus, each individual subsector wants to open their own Talmud Torah, their own school. That's been a key demand of theirs for years. Piron's now willing to bend on that and allow schools as small as 200 to open in exchange for their agreeing to what I was just talking about. So yes, economic incentives and disincentives work. And the government needs to do a lot more of that to draw them into the working world. Just to give you an example, there are over 1,700 Haredi men and women currently studying advanced adult education, professions that would allow them to work in Israeli society at Machon Lev, the Jerusalem College of Technology. It's almost as many Kipot Sergot as they have studying at Machon Lev. And that's only come about, A, because the Kollel stipends have been slashed tremendously, and B, the government has made it feasible for ultra-Orthodox men. We're talking people who are 26, 27, 28, 29, who have several kids, to get scholarships to go study, because they have no other parnassah, and they're giving up their Kollel scholarships. The government has to invest funds to make it feasible for them to study, and then the government has to offer subsidies to places of employment to hire the ultra-Orthodox, just as Israel did a decade and two ago with the Russian immigrants. Businesses were offered, universities were offered, government scholarships, government subsidies to hire new immigrants. And we're going to have to do the exact same with the ultra-Orthodox community. And it's going to cost Israel money in order to bring them in to mainstream society. So yes, I believe that incentives work. The disincentives are very powerful, and that's really the only way.
I just want to make a couple of comments. I think that when it comes to the draft, one of the big challenges with the draft and with the economics is that when the government forces the Haredi community, then the leadership gets their back up, and it becomes an us versus them situation, and that's what you describe in terms of civil war. I tend to think that were the government not to do anything, let's say in terms of working, entering the workforce, natural forces, free market forces would cause a revolution in the Haredi world. The Haredi world is like a train that's barreling forward with the philosophy you must only learn Torah. That's the highest value in the world. You don't go to the army because learning Torah is more valuable. You don't work because learning Torah is more valuable. And it's just a train that's barreling nonstop. Nothing's in its way. So I don't think that would continue if the government did nothing. I think that eventually people would realize they can't sustain this, and they would eventually go to work. I don't think the trains continue barreling forward forever. Life doesn't work that way. It goes in ebbs and flows. It goes up and down. And right now, it's going in one direction, but the market itself would make it go in a different direction. When the government forces things, then the Haredi leadership get forced to take opposite positions, and then the trains are going to keep going. That's my own feeling. If everything was left on its own, people would go to work, they'd get training. Of course, the government has to provide opportunities, but the free I believe in free market, also in the area of the Haredi economics, and I think that less done by the government, other than supporting it, less forcing is going to be the better thing.
Yeah, but Rav Reuven, there was no free market. The situation was that the Haredi world was receiving enormous subsidies for every way stage of life. I have two Haredi brother-in-laws. They pay next to nothing because it's government subsidized in housing, mortgages, health insurance, municipal taxes, and of course, education. I pay more money for the education of one of my sons in Yeshiva High School than my brother-in-law pays for all 12 of his sons put together. So it's not free market. There already is a system in place, or there was a system in place, that allowed this incredible self-isolation and alienation from Israeli society. Call it forcing, call it gentle coercion, call it persuasion, call it economic persuasion. The drawing down of those subsidies is the only thing that will push them out.
I'll try to play this sociologist again, and instead of saying what my view is, try to explain what's happening now in Israel. In doing that, I will save you reading an article that I already published 2 weeks ago. The core argument of that article, that was really about daylight saving time, was that I see something that makes me an optimist when I'm looking at Israeli society. Israeli society can be at times passive and even lazy in responding to problematic trends that erode its power and erode its character. But at some point, Israelis get sick and tired of something, and then they have the power to change it. And I think that with the Haredi, so-called Haredi problem, we've reached that point in which Israeli society have told its politicians, and this happened markedly in the last elections, and maybe began before that with the vast demonstrations of the summer of 2011. Israeli society told its leaders that it will no longer tolerate the preference that Haredi society is getting from the state. The issue of daylight saving time was a very small but very symbolic issue. Israel was subjugated to really some kind of Haredi craziness that enforced a very short daylight saving time on Israel, and Haredi ministers time and again forced Israel to change the clock before Yom Kippur, saying that the extra hour of fast on Yom Kippur will make it impossible for Israelis to fast. Of course, the fast of Yom Kippur always lasts the same number of hours. That's a different matter. So for many years, it was both too short, DST was too short, ended very early, and it also varied in length from year to year in ways that were hard to comprehend. Since we now have a political coalition with no Haredis, and we have an interim Minister of the Interior that is very secular, he decided to get rid of that foolishness, extend DST until the end of October, and I think a vast majority of Israelis were very happy with it, including maybe Haredi families that finally got to travel during the holiday of Sukkot until later in the evening. The 1 hour extra of fast, supposedly, did not have much impact on Israelis, and I don't think we are ever coming back to short DSTs. I think this Haredi thing is over. No Haredi minister will have the power or the boldness to force Israel back to short DST. Now, the larger problem of the Haredi society is, of course, much more complicated to solve than just extend daylight saving time. And really, when we look at this problem, we should understand that it is not one problem. There are three areas in which we have to deal with Haredi society, and these three areas at times interfere with one another. One of them is the financial issue, Haredi burden on Israel finances, the fact that this is a society that doesn't much contribute to Israel's economy, that is a burden on Israel's economy. That's one problem. The second problem is the problem of burden sharing, and that's really a moral problem. I'm not sure if the military really wants to have all these soldiers serving a full 3-year term as combatant soldiers. But it's a moral issue, and Israelis no longer agree to see a growing sector of society that doesn't take part in this daunting task of defending Israel. So that's the second issue. And the third issue is really the issue of the cultural/religious character of Israel. Because the Haredis, when they are in power, are trying to impose on other Israelis their way of understanding Judaism. Now, it is essential for Israel to decide which of the three problems is more important to solve. Because if the economic burden is the real problem, it is possible that demanding military service now from the Haredi society will stand in the way of integrating Haredi society economically. They will resist the draft, they will circle the wagons, and instead of gradually integrating into the larger society, the issue of the draft will enable Haredi leadership to oppose
all kinds of changes. So if economic integration is the most important mission for Israel now, we have to maybe postpone or put aside some other issues in order for them to integrate economically first and only later integrate in other ways as well.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing about what David said about the economic things. The greatest supporter of Torah in the history of the world is the Israeli government. The amount of, I'm agreeing with you, the amount of money which the Haredi community gets in child support payments, in Arnona, real estate tax deductions, in Kollel payments, is enormous. And in agreeing with you, my son, Yosef, is learning in a Haredi Kollel. Our grandson is going to have his upsharon, get his first haircut in a few weeks, so I will have a grandson with payas. And I asked Yosef, how long are they going to be? He said, Abba, they're going to be really long. So Yosef told me that the impact of the reductions that were made by this new government on payments that fellows in his kollel receive amounted to $6,000 or $8,000 a year of reduction in payments. If your whole budget of your family for a year is $25,000, that's what you're living off of, and you lose $6,000 or $8,000, you are in crisis. There's nowhere to turn. Well, there is a place to, and you have to go to work. And if you're not trained, you're in trouble. So I do agree with you, David, that the government's subsidy of Torah is so enormous that by reducing those payments, you will force people to make decisions they wouldn't have made otherwise.
And because of that, Reuven, sorry, and because of that, my brother-in-law says that this government is a destroyer of Torah. That it's like the Babylonians, the Romans of old. And I say, what are you talking about? There's never been a support network for the study of Torah like there is in the state of Israel today. We're making an adjustment. It's not destroying Torah. We're not trying to rip the payas off the ultra-Orthodox community. We're not trying to strip them of their unique cultural identity. We're not trying to empty the yeshivot out. There needs to be an adjustment in a way that draws them closer to us, and there still will be, under any administration, significant support for the wealth of Torah institutions and yeshivot that exist in the country. But you're right that at the moment they're circling the wagons, they've got their back up. Any change, especially if it's supported by someone with a kippah on their head like me or Naftali Bennett, makes us all destroyers of Torah and haters of Torah. And there's a lot of radical language being thrown out right now. I'm optimistic that we'll get past this particularly sensitive, painful stage and move to a better reality.
Yeah.
So just one comment, David, with regard to what you just said. When they cut the subsidies to the Kollelim, so one of the prominent Haredi Rosh Yeshivas said that even in Poland there was never such an anti-Semitic decree. And a friend of mine who is himself a Haredi Rosh Yeshiva but with a sense of humor said, he's right, I know for a fact that the Polish government never cut subsidies to Kollelim.
So this is a very heated issue. I just want to throw in just my own perspective from putting this panel together, which took a very long time. And one of the reasons it took a very, very long time is that I kept inviting Haredim to come on the panel. So I've been working on it for about 2-3 years. Finally, I gave up, which is really, you know, why you have this panel today, is that I gave up. I contacted countless Haredim. And I said things like, you know, come, we'll welcome you, you can say whatever you want, you can disagree, you can bash everybody else. But nobody would take the bait. So I just want to say that if you're thinking in your head, like, why don't we have a Haredi here to defend that position, like, been there and done that.
I do, however, am intrigued by something that you said and that I sort of whispered to you that I'm sure you agree with, which is to let market forces run. Now, leaving aside the fact that I think you've made a convincing case that there is no such thing as, you know, there's plenty of subsidies going on, but leaving that to the side, let's say it was pure market force. So something about this strikes me as odd, right? An analogy sort of formed in my head as you were talking. You're saying it's hurtling, and we should just wait till it stops, right? Because it's going to stop, because it's going to hit a wall. But in the meantime, isn't that sort of, and you like that because you're a quasi-libertarian, right? So, but in the meantime, isn't that sort of giving in to kind of like pouting, right? In other words, let's say you have a child in a room, like two brothers, right? And one of them wants to play with all the toys, and then mom says, yeah, but you know, that's cool, but you also have to take out the garbage. No, I don't do that. You have to wash the dishes. No, I don't do that. But I want my toys. Right? So according to you, he should just sort of keep playing with his toys. He doesn't have to take out the garbage. He doesn't have to wash the dishes. And eventually, he'll find out in life because, you know, if you're antisocial like that, people won't like you and you'll wake up sometime later. Why should I accommodate that? In other words, if the idea of market forces is we just let things happen and people figure it out on their own, but no, there are social consequences for that kind of rejection, for that kind of wanting to have your cake and eat it too. But we're going to start with you.
Okay. I'm going to answer your question, but before I do, I actually agreed with everything that my colleagues here said before, and that's a position I hate to be in. So I would like to seize upon the daylight savings time issue, if I could, because I want to make a more general point. The general point that I want to make is that people in Israel have arguments, but they don't really argue about what they're really arguing about. They always manage to turn it into some other issue that they'd rather argue about. Now, daylight
sort of like what you're doing now, actually.
Well, yeah, but I'm getting it. But I promise to get there within 60 seconds or so, which is not what usually happens. Let's take daylight savings time. Now, the daylight savings, for some reason, Haridim have your Shas in particular, and it's just
the Sephardic Haredim,
okay,
for some reason.
Yeah, I'll tell you the reason. There is a reason.
I know.
Okay? The Yom Kippur story, which is too insane to even take seriously, right, is only the most recent story. Prior to that, they said that they wanted to have less daylight savings time because then Shabbos was out late and people were mechallel Shabbos, okay? Now, none of these reasons are the actual reason. The real thing is that Shas is a fake party. It acts like it's a religious party, but really it's a working class party. And the whole issue of daylight savings time has nothing to do with religion. It's class warfare, okay? And I'll tell you why. It's easy to figure out, okay? If you're a goofball like some of the people up here and you go to work at 10 o'clock in the morning, or you get up whenever you want to get up and you write your little article for the newspaper, right? You don't know what time the sun comes up, okay? So all you want is for the sun to go down late so that you can have a long day, okay? But if you're a Shas voter, you get up early in the morning to go to work in some working class job that starts at 7 or 8 o'clock and you want to go to shul before that and you want to have enough time to daven. That's what the daylight savings time debate is about. And never once has anybody honestly said, this is what it's about. It's class warfare. The people who get up early don't like daylight savings time. Nobody ever says it, but that's the truth. Okay? Now, when it comes to Haredim and the army and free market forces and all that, people here are also dishonest, okay? They talk about shivyon banetel. We want to have equality in carrying the burden. You know what? There's no equality ever in anything, and in the army there surely isn't. Some people go to the army and they serve in Sayeret Matkal and they come home once every 6 weeks and they're training 18 hours a day, and some people serve in Galei Tzahal in Bamachaneh and they're home every day, and by some odd coincidence they tend to be the children of secular elite. So that, for example, the one who's leading this entire battle for Shuvyon Banetel is Yair Lapid, who sacrificed, endangered his life working for the Army magazine for 3 years. Okay? So let's get this equality off the table. It's baloney. Okay? Nobody believes it, least of all Yair Lapid's party. Nobody buys it. Okay? Now, let me tell you what it really is all about. Okay? People resent Haredim for the following reason. They don't want Haredim just to serve in the Army. They want Haredim to want to serve in the army, and Haredim don't want to serve in the army. Now, they don't want to serve in the army for two reasons. First of all, nobody wants to serve in the army, but Haredim can get away with it, and other people can't get away with it, okay? And the way to solve that is by not letting them get away with it, okay? But that's not so simple, okay? The second reason that Haredim don't want to serve in the army is because they identify less with the state, and therefore, in their general balancing of the costs and benefits of going to the army, they see less benefit because they don't get that good feeling of being good patriotic citizens and doing their civic duty because they just don't identify with all that. And we resent them, not because they don't serve and we serve, but because we resent them for acting as if Israel is just another secular country like Poland, and just like Jews didn't want to go to the army in Poland, they don't want to go to the army in Israel, and we resent them for that, okay? So we have to be honest about why we're upset about all this. Now, when it comes down, so now that that's on the table, what really is the problem with Haredim not serving in the army? And the answer is, the real problem is, as everybody here said previously, because they're not only not serving in the army, they're also not going into the workforce. Okay, and the Israeli economy can no longer survive with that larger population not going into the workforce. And when they don't go into the workforce, of course, then they get all the welfare payments and all the subsidies that everybody already mentioned. Okay, so what needs to be changed is the incentives. Now, the most perverse incentives now are not just the fact that they're getting so many subsidies that it doesn't pay for them to work. It's the fact that right now, if somebody for ideological reasons doesn't want to serve in the army, we don't allow them to go to work. It's against the law for them to go to work. We say, look, so long as you're in yeshiva, you don't have to go to the army. But if you, God forbid, go to get a job, then you have to go, then we're going to punish you and force you to go to the army. So obviously, if you punish people for going to work and reward them for staying in yeshiva, they're going to stay in yeshiva. That's what has to change.
Okay, can I make
Sure.
So I want to disagree with one thing. I don't think that's really what the issue is. I think the issue is a deep cultural, religious war between secular Israel and the beliefs, lifestyle, and commitments of the Haredi world. It's not just that the Haredi should go to the army. It's the Haredim don't buy in to Israeli Western society at all, any of the values. For a school system not to have English or the core curriculum, they don't buy. There is a sense that the Torah is lived in total isolation, even from fellow Jews who are secular. It's Torah only. There's no value to secular culture. There's no value to secular education. There's no value to working, unless you just really can't survive. And that's really the issue that I think anyway, part of the whole uprising last year was, we are sick and tired of enabling a society that's backward, that's 17th century, that doesn't believe in the core things of the modern world. And the Haredi community says, and we don't believe in your secularism and your moral relativism and your lack of commitment to Torah and your destroying the Torah, and modern Israel is a tragedy of the Torah, and we don't believe in any of that. In the two societies, there is a deep cultural war of what is the meaning of life and how life ought to be lived, and now it's being played out in the army arena.
Can I just ask a question? I realize you're rehearsing both sides. So let's go back to the brothers in the bedroom, okay? So one brother is arguing about his ideology. We'll call him the Haredi brother. And the other one's arguing about his ideology. We'll call him the secular brother. And in walks the room. A guy walks in with a submachine gun, right? Now, one of the brothers actually has a gun, and the other one could have a gun if he picked it up. But he doesn't pick it up. And afterwards, you know, the one brother defends them and gets rid of the assailant, and he says to him, why didn't you pick up your gun? And he says, well, that's not my value. That's an illogical response. It's not a value issue at that point, right? It's a self-defense issue. Self-defense is not a value, right? It's something you have to do. When somebody sticks a gun to your head, you don't debate ideologically whether you're going to live or die. You take a gun out and you defend yourself. That's why I'm speaking specifically about the army service issue. Now, let's assume, you know, that we've all agreed here that they don't really require all these people to serve.
If you ask my son Yosef, which I have, our son Eli served in the army. Yosef did not serve in the army. He's been learning for 10 years. Went to Or Chaim here. If you ask Yosef, well, Yosef, who is going to defend us? He'll say, Abba, don't you believe that the Torah defends us? Now, the truth is, there are moments in Israel where you think, I know these people. I see them in Rami Levi, and I deal with them. I certainly hope these are not the people that are defending my country. I think he is actually defending our country. So he says that. He honestly believes that the divine protection for the land of Israel, you got to have some people who shoot guns. So his brother is a good shooter of a gun. But he honestly believes, how many people need to learn Torah? Is it 50,000, 60, 80, 20? All right, I don't know, but that's what he believes. So he is picking up the machine gun. It's just that he's doing it with his soul.
So we all have these exact same word-for-word conversations in our families because these issues run deep in the family. And my brother-in-law tries that line out on me. Don't you believe the Torah protects us? And the answer is, of course I do. I really do. I believe it deeply. But the 10 minutes a day that my son squeezes in to learn Daf Yomi, our halacha, as he stands at the checkpoint at the entrance to Ramah with his gun, it's very possible that in Shemayim, when they calculate out the value of those 10 minutes of learning Torah, those are the 10 minutes of Torah that protect us more than 3 days worth of learning Torah in Mir. How does he know that the Torah that his son learns in Tifrach in the Negev is worth more than the Torah that my son squeezes in between guard duty and the army? Who gives him the right to arrogate to himself to make that calculation?
And on that note, you have to leave. So David is rushing off to the airport, so let's give him a hand. He's going to step down now. And Shmuel, you're up.
Yeah, I wish him a safe flight. I'll go back to DST just to counter Moshe's entertaining but not very convincing explanation of battle lines. It is true that there is some truth to what Moshe said about Shas being supportive of shorter DST because of their constituency. I just want to mention that in every public opinion poll done in Israel in the last 20 years, about between 70 and 85% of the population supported a much longer daylight saving time. So we still, if we look at the proportion of the population supportive of longer summer, I think we have a vast majority of Israelis that are happy with the change. And you might be right that those who rise early in the morning are less happy about this, but the numbers do matter in such cases. You can't just say that because I'm a lazy journalist and they have to wake up early in the morning, I have to shorten my days of summer, even if I...
I'm a lazy academic. It wasn't personal.
I have a very thick skin. I'm not easily insulted.
You have to work harder.
Yeah, please try again. Now, as for the Haredi question, look, I somewhat agree with Moshe. I think that Israelis don't exactly tell the whole truth as they speak about their expectations in regards to Haredi society. I think that deep down, most Israelis, myself included, would like the Haredi community not just to join the armed forces and join the economic market, but also to culturally change. Now, do I want them to cease from being Haredis? I can't say I would like it to go that far, but I would like Israeli Haredi society to be of a more westernized nature. I would like it to share more of the Zionist dream, which I think many of Haredis do. I think that the Haredi society today is far from being coherent, and what we hear from Haredi leaders is pretty far from being representative of what we hear from Haredis on the street. I would like to mention one example that might explain why it is crucial to take care of this problem now and not wait for longer. And this, in looking at this example, I look at what happened at the city of Beit Shemesh just 2 weeks ago with the end of the municipal elections. What we had in Beit Shemesh is a secular to traditional small town into which Haredi communities started immigrating. And there's nothing wrong with Haredis living in Beit Shemesh. Haredis need to live someplace, and Beit Shemesh is as good place as anywhere else for them to live. However, the problem with Haredi communities is that as soon as they become a large minority or even the majority, it is no longer tolerable for Israelis, for non-Haredi Israelis to live among them. That's the problem. It's plain and simple. The Haredi majority in Beit Shemesh is going to make life intolerable for secular or traditional Israelis who live among them in Beit Shemesh. So every Israeli who's sober enough to look around him and see what's going on in Beit Shemesh will make sure not to have Haredis in his own neighborhood. If you ask yourself, why is it that secular Tel Avivians among whom I reside, why do they oppose a preschool, a Haredi preschool in the neighborhood? Why would they look with wary eyes at three Haredi families that moved to the neighborhood? Why would they not agree to having a Haredi synagogue in their area? You'd say, well, that's racism. Why not let Haredi synagogue in your neighborhood? Let them have a synagogue and pray. Experience teaches Israelis that if you let these families move to your neighborhood, and if you let this synagogue being built in your neighborhood, and if you let them build a preschool and then a school, you will end up having to leave your neighborhood after having lost 50 or 60% of your apartment's value. Now this is it's a sad reality, but it's reality, and everyone who've been to Beit Shemesh in the last 20 years, and I kept visiting this town time and again in the last 20 years, have seen this process moving forward, and those non-Haredi people who now live in Beit Shemesh will have to leave or stay there under very tough circumstances. For Israel to allow such process to go on in the entire country is a dangerous thing to do. Now Moshe can go back to insulting them.
Let me make one comment about that. Having been the rabbi in Birmingham, Alabama, had that comment been made about people who do not wear black coats and black hats, but have black skin, it would have been outrageous.
He was ready to say that, but he said, "I'm not going to say that." So anyway,
I'm not in the business of being politically correct. I understand what you're saying, and I feel uncomfortable to say this myself. I feel uncomfortable to oppose a building of a Haredi preschool in my neighborhood, but I have no choice. I have no choice if I want to maintain my way of life in my neighborhood. That's all.
It's painful to hear.
It is. It's painful to say.
Let's jump off of the... You're rehearsing in some ways the Chiloni or traditional perspective. And so I want to ask you something. I want to throw something out for you. There's a kind of standard narrative that's often rehearsed about the relationship of most Israelis, especially Chilonim, to the organs of religious authority. And that standard narrative goes something like this. They don't respect the chief rabbinate. They don't respect most rabbis. They don't approve of religious coercion. The level of disenchantment that they feel about the representatives of traditional Judaism has reached an alarming level. They see those representatives as, you know, especially when they go into politics, as corrupt and irrelevant and archaic and all the other issues that we've talked about here about the army and economics. And yet, further to this narrative is the notion that those tensions are of primary concern. Many polls in Israel say that that's more important to them, relationships between Israelis, than even peace with the Palestinians. So first of all, I want to know, do you think that this narrative that gets often rehearsed is accurate? Is the story more nuanced? And if it is accurate, let's talk about something more positive. What do you think can be done to restore dignity to the place of religion in the public's eyes?
Go ahead. I don't know that I have anything profound to say about that.
The previous stuff was profound.
What?
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
The previous stuff was profound.
I just want to know.
Right. So I'm not sure I really understood your question.
The question is, there's a very popular notion, and you've seen a lot of literature, and it's like opinion polls in Israel, that they resent this, they resent that, they resent this, they resent that. There's a big problem. And so here we are sitting up on this panel, presumably connected to Judaism, presumably concerned about the image of Judaism, at least a little. If that's an accurate narrative, so is there anything that can be done about that situation? Is there anything that can restore the place of Judaism in the Jewish state to some level of public dignity?
You're talking about cultural phenomena that are very difficult to understand and even harder to control, okay? The question of when religion is in vogue and when it's not in vogue and what are the reasons for it and so forth are very, very subtle questions. The last thing you want to do is have some central government try to control how these things are going to work from above. It's impossible. The dynamics are very, very nonlinear. The effects are very, very subtle, and they're poorly understood. So I don't think it's even reasonable to ask whether there's something we can do about the spread of religion. The reasons that people who are secular resent religion are very hard to understand. I don't want to get into to cheap psychology. It may not necessarily be a function of how religious people behave or how religious establishments behave. It may have to do with their own guilt feelings or having abandoned their own cultural traditions. I don't want to psychologize. It's too easy. It's too cheap. And I don't think it's really possible. And even if I had some plausible hypothesis for why people had these feelings of resentment, I don't think that I would have any possible plan for dealing with it. These are the kind of things where everybody has to kind of, you know, do their thing locally, try to set a good example as a religious Jew and hope that they have an epsilon of impact, and ultimately the dynamics move in the right direction. But planning, forget it.
I was going to comment that whenever we talk about any groups secularists, Haredim. There is no clear grouping. I shouldn't say there's no grouping. There's a spectrum of people's views, and to talk about the secular ones who don't respect religion, it's, you know, there's a whole spectrum. You know, I live in a neighborhood in Yerushalayim Katamonim, a very Sephardic neighborhood. So my barber, it's a really good rate for the beard and the haircut. It's 50 shekels. So I go to him. So he's got tattoos up his arms on both sides over here. He's got long hair. And, you know, he's whatever. And people coming into the shop all the time, you know, hugging, slapping, whatever. So I go by the shop the other day, and there he is with his tefillin on. The guy's got his tefillin on, and he's davening. I would never have imagined that. So, you know, there's all the whole spectrum of
That's
people.
That's why he needs the tattoo, to make sure he puts it on the right place.
I'll ask him about that. So I think there's a whole spectrum. I think there are things that are going on. I personally feel that the rabbinic leadership, that one of the reasons why there's alienation is that the rabbis in Israel, the culture is, the rabbinic establishment to a large extent is, that we are the protectors, the guardian of the Torah. We're protecting the Torah that those who shouldn't get in don't get in. Those that are not kosher, you know, in restaurants, you know, don't get in. And they don't view themselves as being the salesmen of the Torah. In North America, we view ourselves as selling the Torah to the Jewish people and providing a product that the Jewish people are going to want to buy. Sometimes we do it better, sometimes not so good. In Israel, that notion is foreign. What is a breath of fresh air is, I was speaking to one of the fellows, Zev Schwartz, who runs the Kol Torah Metzion, which is an organization that sends guys out to North America to serve in community kolim and to teach and like Israelis, and then they come back. So he said, you want to have an impact on Israeli religious life? Send more people to Chutz Laretz who then come back. Because he said, all the leadership in the new wave of good things that are going on religiously in Israel are all those people who came to North America, saw a different way of how we deliver religious services, and say, that's a great idea. I'm going to bring that back to Israel. And they come back and they form Garinim, different communities in different cities. And so I think there is a lot of things. There are things that are going on that are tempering the divide between religious and secular that I think is a breath of fresh air.
I wanted to follow up with that in terms of how much of this overall problem here is a kind of a vagueness that, in a sense, haunts the Zionist project itself, right? Which becomes harder to define. You have this original kind of visceral ambition, you want to have a Jewish homeland. But then after that, okay, now we have a homeland. We got lots of Jews in the homeland. What's next? Right? And one has a sense that beyond that initial project, it's hard to say. I'm wondering from your point of view, would an Israeli constitution with sort of clearly defined principles and boundaries, would that alleviate the problem at all?
The short answer is no. Okay, what Elliot was alluding to, just I've been involved in writing a constitution for Israel. Israel doesn't have a constitution. Instead, it has a court that makes up a constitution as it goes. We're not going to get into that. But the problem of writing a constitution is non-trivial. What you need to do in a constitution is there are three main parts. One is you have to define what the state is all about, what its fundamental values are, how you balance conflicting values, such as democracy and being a Jewish nation state. Another aspect consists of establishing the basic rights that everybody ought to have so that other laws can't conflict with those rights. And the third thing is determining separations of powers and what the authorities of various government institutions are. Now, the interesting part is obviously the first part. The other two are rather technical. In the first part, we try to balance various values that we think the state ought to have and somehow define the very character of the state. I alluded at the beginning to a law that that I wrote and is currently being discussed in the Knesset, which attempts to balance the democratic and the Jewish character of the state. The problem is that when you do this, the Constitution is not handed to the public. It's not a declaration of principles that is now going to be discussed in academia. You hand it to judges, and judges are going to do with it exactly what they want to do with it. And the judges that we now have are fairly predictable sorts. Pretty much know what they're going to do with it, which is to interpret all of the liberal parts as generally, as broadly as possible, and interpret all the Jewish parts as narrowly as possible. As a result, just writing a constitution is unlikely to have any significant impact on the character of the state. It might be a lovely statement to which people could refer. I suppose that has certain social and cultural advantages. But in terms of its legal consequences, they're somewhat dubious. And as I said before, in terms of having cultural impact, I think any kind of top-down attempt to force culture in a particular direction is doomed to failure.
Okay. Any last thoughts?
Well, we began this conversation. Moshe was beginning to eliminate the rabbinate. Now he's moving to his next target, which is the Israeli Supreme Court.
Journalists are next.
we are going our separate way by natural elimination. I don't think Israel is likely to have a constitution very soon. And I don't think that having solved the problem of the rabbinate and the Haredis, we can now solve the problem of finding a new mission for the Zionist project. All in all, I tend to agree that the signs in Israel are generally positive. I think that Israeli society is moving in the right direction, as mentioned before, in the sense that this polarizing picture of religious and secular, right and left, it's all blurred now. There are many more nuances, many more, if you like, shades of gray in Israel society. I have many secular friends who now study Talmud or go to different places where they can find or they can express their Judaism without being forced to express their Judaism religiously. I have many religious friends who now try to express their religiousness in ways that were considered untraditional up until 10 or 15 years ago. So Israel is becoming more culturally varied, less polarized. The secular religious issue, except for the Haredi, there is a very specific issue with Haredi society. But other than that, the Israeli society is becoming less polarized. I don't see many people hating Judaism or feeling the need to defend Judaism from its attackers. There is no war on Christmas in Israel, and there is no need to fight the counter war for Christmas in Israel. Israelis learn to live with their Judaism in many different ways, and I think it's getting better.
I think that's a good closing note. Thank our panelists, and thank you very much for coming.